dial-up in the age of broadband. I have a couple of disclaimers before I start reading this. First, this article is under heavy development. I've only barely begun experimentation, but I wanted to share my findings as I made them, and there's also a section of this article that talks about theory more than the specifics, and that part shouldn't be changed very much. Also, I'll be speculating on techniques I haven't tried, but have no reason to think will not work. But take all this with a grain of salt. The other thing is that much of this article has to do with specific step-by-step procedures, which don't make a whole lot of sense in an audio form. So I'm going to go ahead and skip over those, and if you'd like to have the specific steps, you can read the article. Anyway, let's begin. When you're dabbling around with old computers, there is inevitably an idea that'll come to mind. Man, I should get some modems, and of course the idea peters out a little there because we're never quite sure what to do once we have what we want in this hobby. We are eternally cats pursuing laser pointers, but the cat seems to enjoy the pursuit for its own sake. So, the desire is not hard to understand. You want that scream and howl and hiss of static that says you are getting online, as it did in 1996, 90, 87, or 2007 if you lived in Idaho. But I doubt you're nostalgic for that. My first boyfriend certainly wasn't, but we will suppose that you want to be able to replicate this experience. There's a number of reasons to do this. One is to get on the internet, of course. Another is to dial into someone else's old computer somewhere else. Another is to get a serial connection between two devices that are inconveniently far apart for a normal serial cable, but the final one is because you just damn want to. I feel you on all these points, but there are problems with getting two modems to talk to each other in the modern era. In this article, I will help you overcome them so that you can dial in to one computer from another and perhaps get on the internet if you like. If you want the simplest approach and you only want to connect a couple modems in the same room, I have a procedure later in this article that will explain how to do it very straightforward without any of the theory. You could read the article to find that. Also, if your only goal is to get a computer online without the use of Ethernet and your computer has a serial port, you can actually skip the modem step entirely, but I'm still working on the article explaining how to do that. Keep an eye on this article and eventually I'll be linking it. So we'll start out with the concepts behind all this. I'd like to explain a couple things about modems before we begin. First, while your computer does know what a modem is, it doesn't regard it as much more than a means to an end, namely to create a serial connection. For 30 years, computers talked to other computers over serial ports, aka COM ports, aka RS-232. It came in a whole variety of flavors and shapes. Phone plugs, DB25 plugs, DE9 plugs, Mini-DIN 8 plugs, and even heavily cost-reduced forms that used as few as two pins over bare wires. It was perhaps the most universal communication standard prior to Ethernet. It was even used to get pictures off of digital cameras and scanners as late as the early 2000s. Every computer had it, so if you wanted two devices to talk, that's how you did it for a very long time. Serial ports have almost no intelligence. You can send bytes, and you can receive bytes, and that's just about it. There are a couple extra pins, much of the time anyway, which can be used to indicate some very simple conditions like, stop sending me bytes, I'm out of buffer space. But those are optional. And critically, there are no connections in the world of serial. If you get a Cisco router today and plug into its serial console port, as it boots up, it'll spit out hundreds of messages. Unplug the serial cable and the messages will stop. Plug it back in and they start again right in the middle of a word. The router has no idea that your PC was disconnected. In fact, almost every Cisco router in the world is currently turning the data pin on its serial port on and off blindly, pulsing out diagnostic messages just in case anyone is listening. To drive this point home, whenever you connect two computers over a serial cable, nothing really happens. There are no addresses or protocols. There's just a pipe that carries bytes. The computers on each end have to be manually informed that a connection is present, and matching programs have to be executed on both ends and told about each other's existence if you hope to get anything done. This also means you can do virtually anything over a serial port as long as you have the right programs on either end. In the simplest configuration, you can just plug two serial dumb terminals, like those now made by Weiss, into each other with a cable that swaps the transmit and receive wires. Now, when you press a letter on the keyboard of one terminal, it appears on the other, and vice versa. If you were to plug one of these terminals into, say, a serial port on an old digital camera, if you knew the right commands to type, you could get it to send a saved picture, and it would appear as 1,000 screenfuls of gibberish characters, because the camera sends pictures by encoding them into ASCII and throwing them out the serial port with no idea where they're going, if anywhere. Now, the purpose of a modem is to make a very long pretend serial cable, with the two ends represented by the port on the back of your modem and the port on the back of the modem you're calling. Your modem makes a phone call, another modem picks up, they scream at each other, and then they disappear from the equation. From your PC's perspective, once the call is established, it can throw bytes out of its serial port, and they arrive at the far end just as if there was a cable between it and the other computer. It's a 20,000-foot cable, of course, because you're several states away from your destination, but the modem handles all that by turning your bytes into howling noises that survive the trip over the telephone line and get reassembled into bytes at the other end. Think about it like one of the funky little hardware emulators you can buy now to plug into a C64 or the like, the ones that pretend to be a floppy drive but they're really an SD card. Suppose you had, and you can buy these, a gadget that plugged into a serial port on your PC, and then when your PC sent a byte, it packed it up into a packet and sent it to some specific IP address over the internet, where a matching device unpacked it and emitted the same serial signals to another PC, and neither one knew that they were talking over the internet. That's much like what modems do, just over phone lines. Modems also connect to your PC and the computer you're dialing into over serial ports. Generally speaking, your Hayes or US Robotics had a DB25 connector on the back which you plugged into your PC serial port. ISPs had banks of phone lines plugged into banks of modems plugged into special serial cards with 8 or 16 or 32 ports. You could, unquestionably, connect to a dial-up internet service provider by simply plugging a 6-foot serial cable between your PC and their dial-up server. It would be inconvenient, to be fair, but it would work. You might be aware there were modems that didn't appear to use a serial connection. They used PCI or ISA slots or USB, but under the hood, these are still serial connections as well. If you have an old Pentium 3 laptop with a built-in modem, you can confirm this. Go to Device Manager, open up the modem device, and you'll see it followed by COM6 or something like that. This is a virtual serial port created by the modem driver. For all intents and purposes, the modem works just like an external one would. The OS usually tells the modem to make a call by just chucking the right commands out the serial port, whether it's virtual or physical. The modem does its magic, it gets the call set up, it tells the PC when it's prime time, and then it gets out of the way. Any bytes the PC sends after that are just sent down the phone line and reassembled at the other end as if the modem wasn't there at all. If the PC needs to communicate with the modem, it has to send a special series of bytes the user is unlikely to ever enter, which puts the modem into a command mode, at which point it can be told to hang up the call, among other things. In the example I gave above using a dumb terminal, if you substitute the cable between the two dumb terminals with a modem and you type the right command, in this case ATDT and then a phone number, the modem would place a call to that number. The user on the terminal at the other end would see the word ring appear on their screen indicating a call is coming in, and they would have to type ATA to answer it. Their modem would then pick up, your two modems would negotiate a connection, and then you could type letters and they would appear at the other end, exactly as if a serial cable were in use, except the other terminal could be on the other side of the planet. Alright, so why all the theory? Well, maybe you're 20 and you don't quite know what was going on behind the scenes with this stuff. Knowing all this might also make diagnostics easier. I also like talking about it. But regardless of age, it's very likely that all you ever did with modems, if you ever used one, was dial up to get internet. And that's not all there is to it. That's just one of many applications modems can be used for, and in my eyes, that means you have a lot more reasons to experiment with them. You can connect anything over a modem if it speaks serial and can send the right commands. As I suggested earlier, you could, for instance, put a dumb terminal in your bedroom and use a modem to call a matching one at a friend's house and simply type at each other over it in real time. That's silly, perhaps, but you could do it, especially if you're nerds in the beginning stages of a whirlwind long-distance relationship. You can also use modems to make computers available to other people that you know or maybe don't know. It doesn't have to be a network connection you're setting up. You could put a modem on some arcane old Unix system and let randos on the internet dial into it to poke around just for the sake of getting the full retro computing experience. So, now that you understand what modems actually do and some notions of what they can be used for, let's move on to the problems we face and then the solutions. First, a section I call the tyranny of lines. One thing you have to understand up front is that, generally speaking, and I have a footnote on this, modems do not work without a phone line, and a phone line is not simply a pair of copper wires. A phone line provides several things. First, it has to provide a source of 48 volts DC power. It also needs to produce a very specific dial tone until digits have been dialed. When no digits have been dialed for a certain length of time, it considers the call complete, and it begins playing a ringback tone as it attempts to reach the other end. And then it begins sending a 90-volt AC ring signal to the phone that's being called. Now, only after all those things happen can a call actually be established, And if you know anything about electronics, I don't need to explain that these are not easy to replicate with common components. By the time you've created something that does all of this, you've built what's called a PBX, essentially a tiny phone company. This wouldn't be easy to build, you can't get one for under $100, and if you did, it would be a pain in the ass, a tremendous boondoggle to your little hobby project. Now, modems don't technically need all these things to function. They don't need any of it, in fact, but unfortunately they will refuse to operate without all of it. So your first obstacle is that you need something that acts like a phone line, full stop. Here's my footnote about this. I'm told that there's a command you can send to a modem to tell it to initialize a connection without requiring a phone line, just a cable plugged directly between two modems. The AT command for this is ATX3, ostensibly. And what this is supposed to do is to tell the modem that it's okay to place a call even if there's no dial tone. But I haven't really figured out how to apply that information, and there's limits to how it can be used. Specifically, as I understand it, you have to type this ATX3 command at one end, then tell it to place a call, now go to the other end and type ATA to answer the call, and at that point the modems should begin talking to each other. But I've experimented with it and I couldn't get it to work, and more importantly, I think it's kind of moot because I think the actual dial tone and the dialing and whatnot is valuable for its authenticity, if you will. I don't really want to try an approach that doesn't actually have a dial tone and dialing and ringing because I just don't think there's any fun in that. Now, it might be possible, if you were to get this working, to get higher speeds between two devices because for reasons that I will explain later in this document, you will never get more than 33.6 kilobits over the technique that I'm going to describe here. You should theoretically be able to get much better speeds between two modems talking to each other directly. But do you really need high speeds on your dial-up network connection that you're just doing for fun? So there are a few different ways to get a phone line that modems will work over. One of them, obviously, is to get a real phone line. If you aren't doing bad for money, you might think, ah, screw it, I'll just order two phone lines from Verizon. And while they do still sell plain copper phone lines, and you could spend $120 a month on this silly hobby project, I should caution you that the phone lines they sell now are not the ones they sold 20, 30, 40, or 50 years ago. In the 60s, when you placed a call from one place to another, there was a good chance your phone line was being literally directly connected to theirs, making a completely clear channel, if you will. You send a voltage, it arrives at the other end, like a 5,000-foot extension cord. Now, many things changed over the following decades. T1 digital trunks, all digital switching, digital signal processing, and people started to have more and more problems with modems. The technology the phone company used to make voices sound better made modems work worse, or not at all. This was not so much of a problem, but these days things have changed completely. If you order a copper phone line today, there's a good chance that it's nothing more than a voice over IP analog terminal adapter, which is a concept I'll explain shortly here. In other words, your phone line ends at the phone company's central office by being plugged into a thing that has an Ethernet port on the back and turns your call into a Zoom session. I'm not really actually joking about this. Now, for reasons I'll explain in the VoIP section, there's lots of stuff VoIP can do to mess up your modem call. I'm not going to say the configuration of these modern VoIP-backed phone lines is necessarily going to make your modem not work, but it could if the phone company has the wrong settings applied by default. And then you'll have to call them and fight with them to try to get your line set up for modem use, which maybe nobody in their support center knows how to do anymore. And for $40 to $60 per month per line, is that really worth it? Is it really worth it when you can just build the exact same VoIP setup at home for $20? So let's talk about voice over IP. Without getting deeply into the definitions, it's like this. Voice over IP means making phone calls over the internet. It's virtually always accomplished with a protocol called SIP, and there are millions of devices that speak it. It's a potentially very complex protocol, but fortunately, you can ignore 99% of it for our purposes. It works just like a Zoom, Discord, or a Skype call. Your voice is digitized into a series of packets, sent over the internet, and converted back to analog audio at the far end. The most common implementation of VoIP is a native VoIP phone. This looks like an unassuming office telephone, but it has an Ethernet jack and it connects to a phone server, either a local one, called a PBX, or to an internet VoIP provider, called an ITSP, which helps by translating VoIP calls into quote-unquote real phone calls, which allows them to be connected to the ordinary phone system. There's also VoIP soft phones. Those are programs you run on your PC that let you place and receive calls without involving any hardware at all. I've seen some research into using these for dial-up experiments, but so far there's not much meat on that particular rib. The other common hardware implementation of VoIP, and what we're interested in here, is what's called an analog terminal adapter, or ATA. I have a couple pictures of some here. One is a Grandstream HT502, the other is a Cisco SPA122. They're both small plastic boxes, maybe about 3 inches in either dimension and about an inch tall. These are the two most common ones I'm aware of, but every ATA is essentially the same. It's like the backside of a voice over IP phone, so it has an Ethernet port and an IP packet encoder glued to an analog front end with a ring generator and a digital analog converter. Basically, you plug the WAN port into an internet connection, configure it, and out from the phone port pops what looks for all the world like a real phone line. It gives dial tone like a phone, it accepts dial digits like a phone, it rings like a phone when called, but it's a modern single-chip computer running Linux and speaking native voice over IP. Now, these aren't expensive, usually $15 to $20 on the used market, and they're very reliable and easy to configure through a web interface. These devices were invented so that people could switch to voice over IP as the cost and inconvenience of copper phone lines increased. You too can take the same approach. Plug a modem into this device, and with some adjustments, you can make and receive data calls as if you had a real phone line. This is unquestionably the cheapest and most flexible way to do this task, so that's what the remainder of this article will cover. Now, VoIP is extremely flexible, which is both its greatest feature and its greatest downside. There's countless ways to configure it. You can set up your ATA so it connects to a real phone service and you'll be able to call actual phone numbers. You can also make it work without any connection to outside phone service, without a phone number, without a monthly fee, and perhaps without even an internet connection. You can even build your own private phone network on the internet. But I'll just enumerate some of the configurations you can use in this next section, and then we'll address one that should be easy enough for anyone to set up. There's a ton of options and approaches to this, so this will be a lengthy section, and we'll split it into two categories. As a reminder, if you want the simplest approach to make two modems talk to each other, there's a section linked in this article that explains how to do that in maybe about 10 steps. So you can jump straight to that if all you want to do is to get this working. Otherwise, let's talk about all the theory. So real quick, I want to give you some condensed VoIP theory ahead of time. On an ATA, each phone jack is called an FXS port. In VoIP, there is a concept of SIP users, which are like email addresses. So, for instance, 104@192.168.1.15 is a SIP user address. The first part of it is the SIP user, the 104. The second part is the address of the server where that user can be reached. A user ID can be a full phone number, like 206-555-1010, or just an extension, like 104, as shown here. It can even be just someone's name, although almost nobody configures systems like that these days. Now, users have to be assigned two FXS ports to identify them, so the ATA knows which port to ring when a call comes in. So now that you have those basics in your head, let's talk about some of the broad configurations we can have here. In the first category, we only want to make calls between modems that are in the same house, the same building. In all these configurations, you won't be able to call to or from real phone numbers. The first simplest way to do this, and the one that I'll explain later, is to simply call between ports on an ATA. The Cisco SPA122, for instance, which is the one that I've tested this with and I'll be explaining here, has two physical phone jacks in it, and it can be configured with a special config to let you call directly from one port to the other. This is the dead simplest approach, and I'm going to explain how to do this step by step later in this article. The calling modem just dials a phone number on port 1, the ATA immediately sends a ring signal to port 2, the receiving modem picks up, and you're good to go. In this configuration, you don't even actually need an internet connection attached to the ATA after you've set it up, although it does require some kind of network connection or it will assume that it doesn't have service and shut down. I'd want to point out that the Grandstream ATAs, which I also tested with, specifically cannot do this. They look like they can, but they actually can't. There is a feature where you can page from one physical port to another, but it makes an invalid type of ring on the second port. It rings too quickly, and a modem won't recognize it and will never answer the call. Now, another way you can do this is to buy two or more ATAs and do direct IP dialing. VoIP ATAs are smart enough that just being plugged into a network, they can call each other without any sort of extra server to help them. So if you want to, say, put multiple modems in your house in different rooms, you could buy two or more ATAs and configure them to call each other at their direct IP addresses. The process of direct IP dialing can be kind of tricky, but it's not too hard to use once it's set up. Finally, you have the option of setting up a local PBX. There's several options for PBX software you can run on a PC, even a Raspberry Pi if you want, that will provide VoIP routing services, also known as soft switching. They're all very finicky and they're complex to use, and I am not up to the task of documenting those processes, but Asterisk in particular is available in an entirely free form, and I believe 3CX has a free personal use license available. And all you need to do is build two extensions, register your ATA to those extensions, and then have one modem dial the extension of the other. The advantage to this approach is that you can call between your devices with extensions or made-up phone numbers instead of funky tricks inside the ATA dial plan or direct IP dialing, but also it can be scaled to a more complex setup, as I'll explain later. Now, in the second category of options, these will give you the ability to call outside of your house, either through real phone numbers or at least to other people that you're cooperating with. The first option here is to get service with a VoIP provider, or ITSP, an Internet Telephony Service Provider. In this config, you configure your ATAs to register to their servers, and now you'll be able to dial between your ATAs by extension and even by a real 10-digit phone number if you paid for one. And more importantly, they can dial out to actual phone lines, and they can receive inbound calls. This configuration has a potentially huge advantage. With an ITSP, your ATA can usually register from anywhere with an internet connection. This means you could, for instance, leave one ATA plugged into a modem on a server back home, then take another ATA and a laptop with you to a convention, and by simply plugging into a local internet connection, you can dial home and get a data connection to your BBS, MicroVax, or whatever else you have set up without needing a local phone line and without having to haul the unit with you. You'll also have, for all intents and purposes, an ordinary phone line which anyone can call, meaning you can publish the phone number and let other hobbyists call into it. VoIP is ideal for this because, if you're really serious about it, you could get a bank of ATAs, connect them to, say, a multi-port serial card, and assign them all to round robin off of one phone number, and then callers would call in and simply get the first free line available at any given moment. This is a full multi-user dial-in system. The downside, of course, is that you have to pay money for this service. Most ITSP providers charge at least a $20 a month maintenance fee, which might not be worth it for a hobby project. Now, I'm personally using a service called VoIP.ms, and I want to say I don't work for them. In fact, I actually work for one of their competitors. I just Googled and found them. And I use them because they have a prepay-based payment scheme, and a few bucks there goes a very long way. I wasn't able to find any other providers with a fully metered prepay-only fee structure like this, but I'm positive they exist. Now, I do need to stress something about this. If someone gets a hold of your VoIP credentials, they will immediately make thousands of calls to your account before you find out about it. I work in this industry, and I assure you this is extremely common, and if it happens, you'll be responsible for the $15,000 phone bill you will get, which is not an exaggeration. This will happen with post-pay providers, but a prepay VoIP plan solves this problem because if someone does hack your account, they'll just deplete your account balance, which might be $30, and then they won't be able to make any further calls. Your account will just be unusable until you pay it back up. So this kind of prepay account plan will protect you from abuse. Now, another technique you'd use here is to make your ATAs publicly accessible. So you don't register them to a service, but you put them on your network, and then you forward a port from your router to an ATA on your LAN, and then it would be possible for someone outside your house to call it by using direct IP dialing. You could phone home from other places, or you could put your IP address and perhaps several different ports that are mapped to different ATAs on your network onto your website and allow other people to call your vintage equipment from their vintage equipment. The risk of this config, for what it's worth, is you will get thousands of bogus calls a day from hackers. They will find the ports you forwarded, they will hammer your device with bogus calls to the point where it can't be used. There are mitigations to this, but those are out of scope of this article. Now finally, again, you could set up a public PBX and make it available over the internet. Now, one reason you might do this is if you have a vintage hobbyist community service where anyone who wants to participate can request an account on your PBX, register their ATA to it, and they'll then have access to all the other people who have also registered. They'll be able to dial each other's direct extensions or virtual phone numbers, and nobody will have to pay any monthly fees. This is a service I've considered assembling for years, but if you want to get out ahead of me on it, go nuts. The advantage of this setup over the simple port forward to an ATA approach is that a PBX can and absolutely should be configured to require a password. If you're putting a VoIP device on the internet and you can't secure it with a password, it'll get thousands of bogus calls a minute. But a properly configured PBX can reject calls that aren't from authenticated callers. So even if you only want to make a single ATA available publicly, a basic asterisk PBX setup, for instance, can act as a firewall to make the setup more tolerable. So those are all the configurations I think you might be interested in, but let's talk about some common challenges that you're going to run into. First, you should know that you'll never get more than 33.6 kilobits out of any ATA I'm familiar with, but you also really won't get this out of any phone line, and I'll explain the reasons for that in the bandwidth section in a little bit. Also, VoIP has a ton of features for signal processing that are meant to make voices sound better or use less bandwidth, and all these things will damage your data signal because they make perceptual alterations, changes that make voices sound better to the human ear, or that apply data compression that degrades the audio in a way we can't notice, but when applied to a modem signal, they completely trash it. These settings include echo cancellation, which does what it says on the tin, silence suppression, which is when there's no audio, it stops sending packets to save bandwidth, compressed codecs. The native codec of the telephone system is called G.711-MULAW, or G711U for short, but there are others that compress audio and they will all trash your signal. And finally, fax optimization. The overwhelming use case for ATAs these days is probably to hook up fax machines, which use signals very similar to modems, but not quite the same. If an ATA thinks your modem is a fax machine, it will wreck the signal. And you have to keep in mind that every element in a VoIP system can introduce any of these behaviors. If you're just configuring one or two ATAs, you have to turn all these settings off in their config. If you add a PBX into the equation, you might need to turn them off in its config. If you're calling through an ITSP, you may have to turn them off in their config, and that might not be possible. But even with these considerations, I believe you can get a reasonably functional modem call over an ATA. You just need to be aware that it can break in a lot of different ways and expect to have some problems. Now, let's talk about the bandwidth thing. 33.6 kilobits is the highest speed you're ever going to get out of two modems. And the reason for that is kind of complicated. 33.6K is the highest speed that modem manufacturers were able to get working over normal phone lines. When you called your ISP in 1995, your modem didn't get connected directly to theirs. It went through a digital trunking system, where analog-to-digital converters turned your audio into a stream of digital samples. Modem manufacturers pushed as hard as they could, and 33.6K is the most they could ever get through those converters. 56K was implemented using a dirty trick. While your phone line is an analog connection, which gets converted to digital by your phone company equipment, your ISP's modems actually connect to the phone company over pure digital circuits. This means that the audio being generated by the modem on the ISP side doesn't go through a conversion process. Whatever they send is exactly what the phone company delivers. It has to be converted back to analog, but that's not as lossy a process as the opposite direction is. That means the signal going from the ISP to your line is able to carry more data than the signal going from your line back to the ISP. Now, you might not know this, but 56K modems only got 56K downstream. Upload was never as fast as download, and that's due to this asymmetry I just described. Since the data you're sending to the ISP has to go through an analog-to-digital conversion to make it back, it's still limited to 33.6K. There was a technology called V.92, which was able to get roughly 48K upstream, but it was finicky and unreliable and diminished your download speed in the process. Now, if you really, really, really want to get higher speeds, you might be able to use a device called a telephone line simulator, which is a gadget that emulates just enough of a phone line to let two devices call each other and then connects them basically straight together with no digitizing step. These are not usually very cheap, and they only work to connect two modems that are right next to each other, but it's an option if you absolutely must have those higher speeds. It's also true that there were digital modems out there, which spoke the same language the ISP modems did, but I have no idea how to use one or what external equipment might be required. You'd be on your own with that one. Now, if you feel cheated by this limitation, let me remind you that this technology was not even invented until about 1995, and was not adopted in any widespread fashion until 1998. Up until then, 33.6 was screaming fast and was made obsolete only at the beginning of the nascent broadband era. So really, the only experience you're missing out on here is that of the Idaho AOL user in 2002 suffering through loading Flash videos at 56K. This next section here covers procedure, and as I said, I'm not going to be reading every bit of this in the audio. You can read the article if you need the specific steps. But the procedures I'm going to give are how to do two different configurations. The first one is an ATA calling directly between its own two ports. This, again, requires a Cisco SPA-122. The GrandStream ATAs specifically cannot do this trick, and I'm not really aware of any other ATAs worth buying. There are other devices related to the SPA-122, like the Linksys SPA-2102 and the Linksys PAP-2T. These will work, but the 122 is the best option because it has a factory reset button you can hit if you mess up the config and the others don't. It's also the newest, and it's no more expensive on the used market than the others. There are a couple important caveats to the SPA-122. First, a lot of the ones on eBay don't seem to come with a power supply. They take 5 volts, and you need to make sure you get a 5-volt, 2-amp supply. 1 amp will seem to work until you actually make a call and ring one of the ports, and then the device will crash and reboot. Second, you should be aware that all SPA devices have the potential to be locked to a single carrier and nearly impossible to factory reset. To reduce this probability, buy one that comes in a Cisco retail package if possible, and failing that, don't buy one that has the VoIP provider's logo on it. Now, I'm just going to give you the summary of the steps here. You're going to hook the device up, plug a PC into the Ethernet port as if you were configuring like a basic home router, because that is actually what these things act as. You log in, you have to reset the username so you can turn on web access management, and then you hook it up to your LAN and log into it at whatever IP that it gets. Then you have to go into the Voice over IP section, enable a couple options to let it make calls without being registered to a particular ITSP service, give it user IDs, and then give it a very special dial plan that I've written in the article here that just tells one port to dial straight to the other port. Now you just leave this plugged into a network, because it won't work without some kind of network connection. Connect your modems to both ports, tell one to listen for connections, and then have the other one dial its number, and you're off to the races. Now, this should just work. If it doesn't, there's a few things you can do. For the first step, you should probably test to make sure dialing is working, so you're going to need a basic plain old telephone to plug into one port. You dial the number and make sure that it actually rings the other port. If you have a second phone, you could plug it into the other port and try calling between them and make sure you can actually pick up and talk. If all that works, then there's nothing wrong with the dialing process. So if you are successfully getting a call through, but it just fails the handshake process, you hear the two modems yell at each other, but they just give up and don't connect, you probably need to apply the modem optimization settings, which are given in the article. Also, to reiterate, if you're not getting any dial tone when you try to dial, make sure there's actually an active connection on the internet port on the device. If it doesn't have a connection and a valid IP, it'll shut off the voice module, even though it doesn't actually need the network to place calls between ports. So that's all there is to the first config. The second one is a bit more flexible. In this config, you'll be calling between two ATAs, which means you can have one of them in another room of your house or something like that, as long as it's on the same network. There are a lot of ways you can interface two ATAs, so I'm going to explain how to do this with two identical Cisco SPA-122s. If your other ATA is another model, or both your ATAs are another model, you'll have to figure out how to adapt these steps, but the basics are going to be the same. Now, I have not actually tested this process because I can't find any of my other SPA-122s right now, but I have a lot of experience with these. I have very little doubt that it'll work. The basic steps are you set it up just like the previous process, except you need to make sure that both devices have static IPs. You need to give it unique users. So the first ATA has users 100 and 101, and the second one has users 102 and 103. And then I developed a very complicated dial plan that you can find in the article, which you will apply to all the ports, which will allow all of them to reach each other on either ATA by dialing an extension. After you do all this, you just leave them both plugged into the network, and away you go. Now, once you've gotten the dialing part taken care of and the two devices are handshaked, the next thing to do is to figure out what to do over that. One of the most obvious end goals is to get online, and I have an entire other article that you can find linked from this article that explains how to set up a remote access server on Windows 2003. This worked very, very straightforward for me using a Windows server and a Windows client, and I was able to get connected at 33.6K right away. If you want to do it with other platforms like Linux, there's lots of other ways to do it, none of which I've documented yet. Now, another thing you could do is to set up a dial-up system like an old Unix or VMS machine where you get connected directly to a session. That's pretty straightforward. You pretty much just plug the modem into the serial port on that machine, and when you dial it and it picks up, you will get directly into a serial session. You could complicate this by getting your ATA accessible to the outside world so other people could dial in, as I suggested before. Getting a service with an ITSP is probably the best way to do that so that you can get an actual phone number assigned to it. There's a little bit more in the article that I didn't add here because I felt that it was not worth including in the audio transcription, but that's basically all of it. You can check the article for the little tidbits I left out, but they're not a very big deal. If this article was interesting to you, or if you did something interesting with it, go ahead and email me if you like, articles@gekk.info. And if you like my work, consider tossing me a few bucks on ko-fi.com/gravis. It takes a lot of effort, and payment helps me stay motivated. Thank you.